the COVID count, and the vote count. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. 1 month after reopening the state and a few weeks after some students and teachers returned to their classrooms, what's the state of the coronavirus in South Florida?
We were flat for a while, and it's starting to creep up a little bit. So we'll have to see what happens, but it is a little bit concerning.
Meantime, tens of thousands of people are voting every day in South Florida. Hialeah helped deliver Florida for President Trump 4 years ago. Issues like health care and the economy matter, but so does patriotism. What do the politics of Hialeah tell us about the races this year? And will there finally be a rail link between Miami and the beach? Your phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. The program made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. In-person early voting across South Florida continues. Thousands already have cast ballots in Broward, Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach counties. Meantime, millions of vote-by-mail ballots have already been returned. The coronavirus pandemic has likely fueled this increase in mail-in ballots, as is the high interest in the 2020 election. We'll talk more about the election later on in this program. You can join our conversation. Are you still undecided about your vote for president? What other races or issues are important to you? Undecided voters, NPA voters, we do want to hear from you later on in the program. Call now, 800-743-WLRN. Blue, red, or undecided, same phone number for everybody on the South Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. But first, the coronavirus. Florida is seeing cases rise almost a month into the Phase 3 reopening. I spoke with Mary Jo Trepka about the trends. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist and chairs the epidemiology department at Florida International University. Dr. Trepka, welcome back to WLRN and welcome to the South Florida Roundup. How would you describe the stage that our region is in right now in regards to COVID-19?
Well, I would say relative to many other parts of the United States, we are in much better situation. The Florida's rate, average number of cases per day, is lower than the national average and certainly much lower than what we're seeing in the upper Midwest. Having said that, though, there have been some worries, some signs over the last couple of weeks in the sense that we've started to see an increase in the number of cases, as well as the people testing positive within the state of Florida. Certainly nowhere to the extent that it was back in July, but we were at a nadir in terms of the numbers of cases, percentage of positives in the end of September. We were flat for a while, and it's starting to creep up a little bit. So we'll have to see what happens, but it is a little bit concerning.
How concerning is that creep, that daily percent positive number that had been kind of the threshold? We're right at that 5% plus or minus, you know, a few dozen or a few hundred cases.
Right. So we're not having exponential growth right now. The concern is that this could become a surge with exponential growth, because certainly that's what we saw this summer. So that's why I think it's really important right now that people wear their masks, do what they can individually to try to keep community transmission rates low. I mean, I can say, you know, in Miami-Dade County, we're having close to 500 new cases a day. It's not like we don't have COVID-19. COVID-19 is here, and we're still having transmission. Given that everything is open right now, the schools are open, it's really important that we do what we can in terms of personally wearing masks when we're within 6 feet of other people, staying home when we don't feel well, not attending large events, because if rates go up, we might have to start shutting things down again, and people don't want to do that. I mean, there's a lot of adverse effects of shutting things down, but we have to protect the healthcare system, because this summer our healthcare system was at its brink. It really could take no more cases. We were so fortunate that the rates finally did come down.
With the number of cases that Miami-Dade County, for instance, is experiencing each day, as an epidemiologist, are we still experiencing community spread of the coronavirus?
We're absolutely experiencing community spread.
And why is that designation important?
Well, it's not that we have one little outbreak in a nursing home or some other institution. Rather, we are seeing cases throughout the community at pretty high levels. You know, at 500 cases a day, that's a lot of new cases. And we know that we don't have every case diagnosed that exists, because many people are asymptomatic. So probably there's at least twice as many people who are currently infectious with COVID-19 that we don't even know about.
What about the patient profile? How has that changed? Has it at all? The governor talks about the age of folks who are testing positive and talks about the very low fatality rate for younger folks who have it. What are we experiencing?
Well, the median age in Florida is currently at 38, which is higher than it was in the beginning of the summer when there was a lot of transmission among young people. The issue is that COVID-19 also kills young people, number one. Number two, COVID-19 results in long-term effects for many people who are infected. It's not like everybody who doesn't die suddenly feels well once they recover. We have a lot of people that have long-term neurological problems, cardiac problems. I don't think we even begin to understand how people are going to be affected over the long term.
I want to ask you a little bit about statistics and how they're being communicated. You deal with these numbers each and every day. You're a medical professional epidemiologist, so you understand how best to read these as a scientist and how to communicate them in the public. The governor in Florida particularly has made a case about statistics and in fact sends out daily emails. And one of the emails sent out this week, I'm reading it right now. It says the number of vaccines and therapeutics in development, 213. Number of vaccines in clinical testing, 36. These are facts of COVID-19 that the governor says you won't read in the news. Are these important? How do they play into communicating this virus to the public here in South Florida and information that community members ought to know in regards to the state of the virus?
Well, with respect to the number of vaccines that are in trial, there are a lot of vaccines that are currently being studied at many different stages, the preclinical, phase one, phase two, phase three. I think it probably is only useful right now looking at the phase three, because those are the vaccines that have shown enough promise, have been safe enough that they're being tested in large groups of people, like 30,000 people. I am very hopeful that we will have a vaccine. However, those trials have to be completed. A vaccine is not a therapeutic. By that, I mean that if you are sick, you need a medication, you will get a medication, right? Because the not treating you, there's a larger risk associated with that. With a vaccine, vaccines are given to healthy people to prevent an illness. So we have to have a very high standard of safety to give a vaccine. So we need to have the results of these phase three trials in order to know which of these many vaccines is going to be a safe and effective vaccine. Hopefully there'll be several of them. And I am hopeful, but that doesn't mean that we have those vaccines now. I don't know when we're going to have those vaccines. I hope that we'll have the vaccines, you know, sometime in 2021, but they're definitely not ready now. We need to have those phase three trial results, and we have to have at least one vaccine that is safe and effective.
And then, of course, a distribution plan for that vaccine or vaccines as well.
That's right. And then there has to be a discussion about who gets the vaccine first. Presumably, it will go to those people at higher risk, for example, the healthcare providers, because we have to protect the people working in our hospitals, right? But then the people who are elderly and other people at high risk of dying. The time period from when we get a safe and effective vaccine until we can provide enough vaccine to the entire population to get herd immunity, that's going to take some time. And until that time occurs, we have to keep the transmission rates low enough so that our hospitals are not overwhelmed. So I think that's really our goal. And if we're not able to do that, we have to shut down. And nobody wants to do that. And that's why I'm urging people to please continue to wear their masks And there's no economic downside to not wearing your mask. Yes, it's unpleasant, but I think we all have to do our part because we're all in this together.
Mary Jo Trepka is an infectious disease epidemiologist at Florida International University. I'm Tom Hudson. We are on the South Florida Roundup. Dr. Trepka, the schools reopened in South Florida 2-3 weeks or so ago. The governor declared the state of Florida was in phase three reopening a month ago. Has enough time elapsed to determine any impact that those actions have taken on infection rates and spread?
I'm thinking the beginning of November is when we're going to truly see the impact. The reason I say that is that there's generally some spread that is undetected, especially with young people, because those are the people that are most likely to be asymptomatic. It is very possible that we have unrecognized spread among young people. And then older people start to get infected, and then they show up in the hospitals, and then we know about those cases. So if we can keep our rates really low through November, that'd be just absolutely fantastic.
What does really low mean to you as an epidemiologist?
I think if we can keep the percent of people testing positive below 5%, we keep the number of cases, at least say in Miami-Dade County, in the 100, 200 cases a day, that would be very, very good. And I would congratulate all of us if we can make that happen. But I am concerned because over the last couple of weeks, we have seen an uptick in the state as well as in South Florida, Broward and Palm Beach in particular, and also with respect to Miami-Dade in terms of the numbers of cases.
If you were to advise public policy makers about certain triggers as they're watching that infection rate, maybe not each day look at that daily rate, but look at the trend, at what point do you start to get more concerned about putting potential restrictions back into place?
I think you have to look at all the pieces of data. For example, first, the testing data, percentage of people testing positive, the number of positives that we're seeing each day, and then what's happening in the hospitals. If we start to see the number of admissions due to COVID-19 being much greater than the people who are discharging, then we have to really think about dialing back. Unfortunately, what we saw this summer is that the rate of increase was much steeper than the rate of decrease. So it took us a lot longer to get down than it took us to get up.
This week, the Florida Surgeon General, Scott Rifke, has announced that the state will review dozens of deaths that were blamed on the virus. And this follows criticism by the Florida Speaker of the House, Jose Oliva, who questioned how COVID deaths were being classified. The state review points out that dozens of COVID deaths were weeks or months after the person had tested positive initially for the virus. So first, Dr. Trepka, is this kind of review standard practice?
No, I don't think it's standard practice. I mean, I think it's fine to do an additional review. Having said that, though, it doesn't surprise me that some people's deaths could be due to COVID and they could be delayed, because I already told you about that we recognize that people have cardiac damage that is damage to their hearts, they have damage to their lungs, they have neurologic problems. So that doesn't surprise me that we do have some deaths that would occur after the acute infection.
And would it be medically appropriate to classify those deaths even weeks after on COVID?
When a physician classifies the cause of death, there's what's called the underlying cause of death, and then there's the immediate cause of death. What's important is the underlying cause of death. So the underlying cause of death would be COVID, even if the person had, say, myocarditis, some cardiac problem related to COVID a couple, you know, weeks down the line or so forth. So it's the cause of death is always the underlying cause of death.
Let me ask a question that's on the minds of a lot of parents and children in South Florida. Halloween is coming up. What ought the trick-or-treat scenario best be to practice appropriate protocols?
I think that people have to maintain the 6 feet between other people at all times. So maybe people can leave the candy at the end of the driveway or something like that. You know, it's so sad for the kids that Halloween is probably going to be affected due to this pandemic. But I do think there's probably safe things to do as long as people are outside and they're keeping their distance. Watch out for crowds of people. You know, you want to avoid that. And parents need to do the part to, you know, keep the kids 6 feet apart from everybody else.
Dr. Trepka, an early happy Halloween to you.
Thank you. You too.
That's Mary Jo Trepka with Florida International University. Still to come, what does the Latino vote really mean here in South Florida? More on that and your phone calls and tweets. Undecided voters, NPA voters, we want to hear from you. Call now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Hialeah is known as the City of Progress. It sits just outside the city of Miami. It's the sixth largest city in Florida and is home to many Cuban Americans. These voters are key for any politician to win Miami-Dade County and the rest of Florida by extension in this presidential election year. Hialeah voters helped deliver the state for Donald Trump 4 years ago, even as Miami-Dade County voted for Hillary Clinton. Now, a recent report by Politico looks at Hialeah as really a case study in this 2020 election cycle. The city's politics, the dynamics, the attempts to answer a complicated question. What does the Latino vote really mean, especially after the 2016 election? We're going to focus on Hialeah and the Latino vote in South Florida. We want to hear from undecided voters across the region. 800-743-9576. Are you from Hialeah? Maybe you grew up there, live there, do business there. How are you thinking about the presidential election this year? What are the issues that you're thinking about most? If you're still undecided here with a little bit more than a week to go before the end of voting, join the conversation. Let us know. Share that experience at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Politico's Sabrina Rodriguez joins us now. Her story is headlined, "Will Flag-Waving Latinos Win Florida for Trump?" Sabrina, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Really marvelous case study of Hialeah. What drew you to that municipality to take a closer look at?
Yeah, so, you know, the big thing is I'm from Hialeah. So, you know, growing up here, and I say here because I'm down in Hialeah right now, you know, the big thing for me was seeing, you know, there's so much love for Republican candidates typically. You know, it's everyone talks about, you know, Hialeah is traditionally conservative. Hialeah is, you know, a very Republican, very Cuban area. But, you know, when we look at 2016 numbers, the reality is that Hialeah was fairly split. Hialeah actually voted almost equally for Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. as for Donald Trump. So coming to 2020, you know, you walk outside in Hialeah, you go on the streets and there's Trump 2020 flags everywhere, cars with the 2020 bumper sticker, American flags selling out at the local Home Depots. And, you know, that posed the question for me, you know, why, you know, what is this love for Trump and the United States all mixed together? And that kind of explains why there's just so much energy here surrounding him.
Yeah, and I'll explore some of that energy that you've been able to, you've experienced firsthand. As you mentioned, you're there now, you grew up there, and you've been reporting on Hialeah for Politico. But back to that 2016 result, as you mentioned, Hialeah was really split, but those red parts of Hialeah wound up being added, of course, to the deep red parts of Florida elsewhere, and that helped now President Trump really make up the vote differential of Democrats in South Florida who voted for Secretary Clinton, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why ultimately the Trump administration has made an effort to frequently come down to South Florida and has, you know, touted its Cuba policies because they know that they have a reliable base of Cuban voters.
And I think key to that messaging we've heard certainly from the Republican Party generally and specifically President Trump is are the labels of communism and socialism as it relates in this 2020 presidential election here in the United States. Walk us through how voters in Hialeah in this cycle are responding to this anti-socialist messaging or the labeling, the attempt to label former Vice President Joe Biden as a socialist, a label and a characterization that is false.
Yeah, I mean, it's prominent messaging down here. You hear it on a regular basis that people won't vote for Joe Biden because of him being a socialist. You know, I had the conversation with former Mayor Raul Martinez, who he was saying, you know, well, there's plenty of silent Biden voters. And the reality is that people just don't want to speak up because they don't want to be labeled in a Cuban community as socialist or communist, the way that the Democratic Party has been described down here. So it's been a big focus of that. And, you know, the thought here has been from all the different officials I've talked to is, you know, if you're not supporting Trump, then you must be a socialist. You must not love this country. So there's an association with the socialism and the communism aspect of this that is saying, oh, well, if you like Joe Biden, then you must be a communist and you must not love this country.
You mentioned the former mayor of Hialeah, Raul Martinez. He joins us for this conversation, as a matter of fact, Democrat, former mayor of the city, currently a radio host on Caracol, 1260 AM. Your Honor, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me and sharing some thoughts with Sabrina, which I believe she wrote an excellent article. And the best part is that, you know, she's young. She still lives in Hialeah. She's proud of it, just like I am. And I'm glad that she clarified in 2016, the latest count that I had, I think Hillary actually beat Donald Trump by a few votes. Now, what is the difference? And she asked me, what's the difference now? Is that you got to remember, Joe Biden got into the race late. The candidate that was supposed to have won the primaries and be the candidate was Bernie Sanders. So what did the Republican Party did? They found words that would resonate against Bernie Sanders, and he was a socialist, a Marxist. Well, first of all, you know, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. He's independent. And he has said that he's a socialist. So what they started with, they haven't changed their tune. So a lot of people are confused about who is Donald Trump running against. Is it Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders?
Is there real confusion, though, about who the Democratic candidate is?
Joe Biden's the candidate, but they associate this party now with the party of Bernie Sanders, with the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And there's not a conversation that you have with someone down here where if you try and correct that, you know, Joe Biden isn't a socialist, it doesn't come up well, but, you know, Bernie Sanders is going to get what he wants in a Biden administration, or AOC is going to take over if there's a Biden administration.
Former Mayor Raul Martinez is with us, former mayor of Hialeah, radio host now on Caracol on 1260 AM. Sabrina Rodriguez is also with us, Hialeah native, proudly also a journalist, wonderful journalist for Politico, who has written a real interesting case study about Hialeah here in the waning days of the 2020 election. On the South Florida Roundup, I'm Tom Hudson. Your calls, are you from Hialeah, do business in Hialeah? Are you still an undecided voter, regardless of where you're at in South Florida? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. In Miami, Mariela is with us. Mariela, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I would like to first, if I could, correction, if not calling us Latinos, but calling us Hispanics. I think that Latino wording seems to be out from the out west of California. I think we call ourselves Hispanics.
I agree. I agree with Marilena, and I've tried to communicate nationally that in Florida, you know, we consider ourselves Hispanic, not to denigrate the Latinos in the West Coast or Texas or what, but that's part of the messaging. Here consider ourselves Hispanic. And getting back to the socialism, look at Hialeah. Look at the sectionary certificates. Look at the food stamps. Look at the free lunches. Hialeah is the only city, believe it or not, that owns apartment for people that are underprivileged, and they pay $400 a month. Mm. So they're benefiting a lot. But the party itself, the Democratic Party, and I've been involved with the Democratic Party all my life. I'm not that active now because I host a radio show. And I was always a Democrat. I never changed. I stood my positions. And people loved me until I decided that I was going to retire. And now they're still looking for me because the best times of Hialeah was when a Democratic mayor ran the city.
Former mayor, just hold on. And Marielle, I know you're still with us as well. I want to go back to your original critique and have Sabrina here talk about this difference of labeling or titling, characterization, Latino and Hispanic. How do you hear that, Sabrina? And how are the parties using those words?
Yeah, I mean, Mariela, I hear you completely being from here and not being used to hearing all these different terms. You know, I think that is a problem that we've seen. You know, there's the Republican Party has definitely criticized Democrats a lot for you trying to impose labels on Hispanics or Latinos or Cubans or however you want to identify. But there's a feeling that, you know, these white Democrats from, you know, Washington, D.C. are trying to impose Latino, or even the one that's less popular is Latinx. And that's not a popular term in Miami. That's not a term any of us grew up with.
Exactly.
And it feels weird to have that imposed. So it's, you know, some people I would say in the Democratic Party are trying to navigate how to do that. I thought it was really interesting when Elizabeth Warren was running for president, she would say Hispanic, Latino, and Latinx, which sometimes seemed annoying, but it was the way of saying, okay, everyone identifies differently. There's people in Texas that identify as Latino, and there's people in Miami that identify as Hispanic. So let's just call all the names. It's definitely something that the Republican Party has taken advantage of to point out an issue with the party.
Marielle, I appreciate the critique there. I know that wasn't your initial point in calling in, but thank you for that little detour, an important one at that. But go ahead, your initial point, or your first point, your primary point, rather, Mariela.
Well, yeah, thank you. So I am from Miami. I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in Miami. I was born in L.A. I speak both languages fluently. My parents were, you know, Spanish speaking, could not speak English. Either way, I had a lot of opportunities in this great, great country of ours. We were poor. We were poor, but we made it through and we worked really hard. And we had, you know, the help from the government. But I think it's time that, you know, we really start looking at our country and how much has changed. I am a Republican, and what I'm seeing, what really hurts, is that the country, the foundations of this country, is being torn apart. And it's being torn apart by, by the liberals in their point of view. We need to come together, and we need to come to the center like we used to.
Mariela, give me an example of... sorry for the interruption, but let me hear... I'd like to hear more about your concern there about, as you phrased it, the country being torn apart, and attributing that to the Democratic Party. You said liberals, but I'll take a little bit of creative license there. Why do you feel that way?
Because you're seeing in the media, in the you know, not the conservative media. If you look at ABC, CBS, NBC, everything is totally against the conservative party. I am a born again Christian.
What is it? What is it against? Conservative values? Tell me a little bit more.
The conservative values. Look at the Supreme Court nomination as we speak. You know, they are making every possible move to try to block that nomination.
Not the media is not, right? I mean, this is something that's within the United States Senate.
Yes, but if you listen to the media, all you hear is liberal point of views. I mean, you really do not hear any conservative point of view, and the country is conservative. We are still conservative.
So share with us, Mariela, again, this idea. What is it that's being torn apart? Tell us, give us some examples. I mean, you talked about growing up in Hialeah and having to participate in some government programs to help your family.
Right. What's being torn apart is that doors have been left wide open. anyone and everyone wants to come to the United States because this is a beautiful country. But, you know, when we came here, we had to apply for laws. We didn't come here illegally. We had to actually get in line and get in line with everybody else. By what I believe the Democrats are doing and keeping open doors to all countries is changing this country.
Yeah, Marielle, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us on this, and sounds like immigration is that particular issue that's galvanized you. Yeah,
I am one of them. But let's keep our laws.
Mariella, thanks for joining us here on the South Florida Roundup. Sabrina, immigration in Hialeah, certainly healthcare is a significant issue. We know this in Hialeah. We know that the Hialeah zip codes are among the busiest in the nation when it comes to those that sign up for the Affordable Care Act. We are a community of immigrants, and Dade County, majority foreign-born. What do you hear from Mariella there and reflected in your reporting in Hialeah?
Yeah, I mean, speaking to just what I've seen in Hialeah and the conversations I had, I mean, there is some level of contradiction that's just normal when you're talking to people in Hialeah of, you know, a lot of Republicans that support the president, that support, you know, what he represents for the country and conservative values and that side, which we heard from Mariella. And then there's obviously the reality that, you know, in Hialeah, for example, there is such a large sign up for Obamacare, the same policy that the president has said he wants to get rid of, or the same way that, you know, there's lots of Cubans in Hialeah that are still, you know, sending remittances to their family, are going to visit the island frequently to see their family, but then are supporting the president's restrictions that make it harder to do those things. So there's a level of, you know, a professor at FIU, that's a Cuban American history professor, Michael Bustamante, he phrased it to me as like a cognitive dissonance in this community. And I think it does, where, you know, support for Donald Trump here transcends a specific policy, and it's more so the rhetoric and more so, you know, the way he talks about the country that's influencing people.
Humankind is unique in the ability to hold two conflicting thoughts in our minds at the same time, sometimes two conflicting ideologies. Former Mayor Martinez, I'm wondering, what did you hear from Mariella, and what do you make of this contradiction that Sabrina points out in her reporting?
No, you know, what I was trying to get in and talk about, you know, with Mariella is, first of all, I've been in this country since 1960. I've been in Miami all my life. I lived in the United States during the Vietnam era. I lived here during 9/11, and we all became united. There were different opinions. Now, the question that I would have for her is, who has brought this division that we now see in the United States? Donald Trump, the president of the United States. Instead of being the president for all, he wants to be the president for the few, and he's the one that is instilling this hatred. You know, I don't share her thoughts on the Supreme Court justice, but let's be fair. Obama had 10 months before his term ended, and Mitch McConnell has glowered on the fact that I blocked all the judges. Now they're rushing this woman. She might be bright, but there are issues. There are issues that she's going to sit in the Supreme Court and try to write laws, not as it's supposed to be interpreted. She's going to be writing laws on Obamacare, on DACA.
Well, right. As a justice, issues. She won't be writing legislation. She'll be interpreting the legislation that's written.
The Supreme Court can basically override the legislation and the intent. So in the case of her, it's like all Democrats, we're not religious. We're not Christian. Of course we are. Of course we're. She has her views on abortions. That's fine. I'm not pro-abortion, but I'm telling you that it's a woman's right to decide what she wants to do with her body.
Former Mayor Martinez, hold on one second. I know it's hard for one radio host to be a guest on another radio program sometimes, but I want to get Sabrina back in here to talk about the issues that you've picked up on with those Hialeah voters that you've you grew up with, but you've obviously spent some time now as a journalist. And what you're hearing from the former mayor Martinez, as well as Mariela, talking about these much larger issues, right, that do have a play in everyone's life. The Supreme Court and the rulings that are made at that high court certainly can have an impact on each and every American's life. Are those the issues that the voters in Hialeah are weighing as they're going to the polls in 2020?
I mean, I can only speak to the conversations I've had, obviously, in reporting and within my family. And I mean, you know, the Supreme Court is not the top of mind issue. You know, a lot of people care about housing. They care about their health care. They care about Cuba policy. They care about the economy. And the one that, you know, ends up being the biggest selling point for Trump is this perception that, you know, he's the one that's the best on the economy. He's the one that is going to help recover from the pandemic. And for some reason, there's not an association of necessarily that he has done poorly or done excellently in handling the pandemic. It's been that, oh, he's going to save the economy, and there's a focus on the economy. And that really, you know, I'm sure Mayor Martinez has his thoughts on if that's actually accurate or not, what people are thinking. But in terms of the conversations with people, it's, you know, Trump is there's still this perception that Trump is this savvy businessman and that he, you know, has been successful and that he embodies this, you know, American success story. And that, you know, whether true or not, that is part of his appeal down here.
Sabrina Rodriguez is a reporter with Politico. Sabrina, thanks for sharing your reporting with us. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And former Mayor Martinez, always nice to talk to you. Thanks for your time this afternoon as well.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Raul Martinez, the former Hialeah mayor and a radio host at Caracol 1260 AM, talking about Hialeah as a case study here in the 2020 election. Still want to hear from voters. We're also going to talk about transportation now. Big step on public transit taken this week in Miami-Dade, a project gaining momentum as voters in the county decide who will be the next mayor in Miami-Dade County. Transit, politics, and you coming up on the South Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. A major transportation project moving forward in Miami-Dade County this week. County commissioners approved a $14 million budget to design a monorail. It would run 4 miles over the MacArthur Causeway, connecting downtown Miami and South Beach by rail for the first time since streetcars made that trip back in the 1930s. That's assuming it's eventually built. All of this comes during an election year, of course, and at least 6 of the 13 members of the Miami-Dade County Commission leave office next month. The monorail is part of the county's ongoing transportation plan. It includes expansion of bus lines in South Dade and a high-speed Brightline train in northern Dade County. Miami-Dade County Commissioner Sally Heyman is back with us on WLRN. It's been a while, Commissioner. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Appreciate it. We're taking your calls about transportation. We'll continue to talk a little politics as well. What do you want to see happen as a new Miami-Dade commission begins next month when it comes to public transit? 800-743-WLRN. What's working, what's not working in moving around South Florida? 800-743-9576. So, Commissioner, why approve the contract for this monorail system design now?
Well, you've seen a lot of moving parts for a lot of years. And when you have transportation and mobility being the priority through this last four-year administration, and before that, for 2 years after the recall of the mayor, and before that for some of us, it's been an obligation back to the taxpayers of Miami-Dade who supported the half penny, back to all the residents stuck in congestion. And it was a sense of urgency. If we prioritize transportation, do it with the 13 of us, including Jimenez, who used to be a commissioner, while we're here, instead of, as you said, a 5 or 6 that may be new seats. Yes. And assure continuity.
So it sounds like a combination of running out of patience, election day, and term limits kind of helped lead to approving this contract this week.
Yeah, patience has never been one of my virtues, so I've been egging the Northeast Corridor for over 20 years, working on it with Dave Broward and Palm Beach as a coalition. Before there was a Bright Line, before there was even online, it was the FBC Railroad.
Right.
And so it was a long time coming, but, you know, it just sort of lined up and lined up, and then it was like, make it happen. Where everything was set for rail passengers on a region, so why not with one stop in Dade County since it started with us? So we already got the Aventura in the Northeast Corridor as a stop in Frick County.
So that's the Bright Line side of it. I want to ask about that in a moment. Let me stick to monorail here for a moment, if I may, Commissioner Heyman.
Okay.
Lots of different rails happening, right? Lots of different rubber and rails. And one of those with the monorail, the county's own assessment was to extend Metromover as opposed to the monorail. So again, why the urge to go with the monorail route, which is this public-private consortium?
Okay. One, no new taxes. So that was part of the why not the Metro Rail extension on it. The second thing is we had incredible competition for the Metro Rail, i.e. PTP money coming in from the taxpayers, where this monorail proposal was a P3 concept of private funding with a private developer. And the other thing was Metro Rail would have been pretty much linear and closer to the ground, where it was decided with between sea rise, climate change, king tide, and everything else. We need to go up in the air. And so the biggest thing was putting us on a monorail system across the water instead of small cars or single passenger cars, Metro Rail. So it was a suggestion by the county, but this prevailed as a better option.
Let me unpack a little bit about the dollars. Money always matters in this case. This is an $8 million deal for the design work over 18 months. The total expense is what, $14 million? How do we get from 8 to 14?
Okay, a part of it is a design study, which are always required when we're in pursuit of other monies besides our own. So whether it's state and or federal, and we've seen federal money come in for like the South Dade bus route to rail, you have to have that done. And so an obligation set by the private enterprise, which I think is now called Meridian, is if we're going to do all this study, we need to back it up with, if you fail to move ahead and continue with this, where are you going to reimburse? So the $6 million is coming in behind the $8 million to move it ahead. It will be for the extra $6 million. It will be for following up and part of the cost if we continue. If we don't, then if they're going to be out $8 million for a study that could be used by others or the county, you need to compensate this penalty $6 million. Otherwise, it's $14 million in.
Gotcha.
An ambitious project.
So the additional $6 million, just so we're aware, could be a penalty that the county has to pay if they decide not to go forward with the monorail.
With this company, yes.
With this particular company. Gotcha. Okay.
Yes.
We got a caller here, James in Miami, Commissioner. Let's hear from him on the blue line. Go ahead, James. James, are you with us? I will let our control room know I cannot hear James. I'm going to put him back on hold just in case he happens to be there. Let me know. Commissioner, you mentioned the Bright Line, the Northeast Corridor, the commission moving fast on approving a station there, and then some confusion about whether or not Bright Line would be allowed to actually stop its trains on the Florida East Coast Railway tracks in Adventura. Are you satisfied that that's been cleared up?
The Aventura one is separate. That made a single stop intra-county. Otherwise, it was Miami Central, downtown Miami, then downtown Fort Lauderdale, downtown West Palm, as a Virgin Bright Line regional onto Orlando. When the virus hit and Virgin sort of pulled out, Bright Line initiative was hey, we're going to focus on commuter for the first time, which pleased all of us in Miami-Dade.
Right, but there was some confusion about whether or not Brightline had the ability to run on the FEC tracks and stop in Aventura instead of just going.
Not in Aventura. That has been set. That was separate.
What was
the confusion was a suggestion that we're going to have a full commuter line, but you have to realize that it's FEC, I and FECR that have the rail and control access, and Brightline has to pursue that with them. I have a piece of legislation that will be coming hopefully next week after the elections for my colleagues while we're all still here, and as much as a rush, it's to put all the last of the fluid pieces together. You already had a commitment on the smart plan that is years old.
Yeah.
I've been on this Brightline corridor of the FEC for over 20 years as a former state representative.
Yep.
And it was constant moving pieces of what the access ability is. Now we're pursuing it. It must be due diligence and future commuter stops based on FEC, FTA, FDOT, and Farebox rates for ridership and success, commuter access, but private dollars for the platform station stops.
Yeah, yeah. Commissioner, let me bring in James here because I think we figured out our technical problem here. James, I'll let you know we got just about 90 seconds left, but wanted to hear from you quickly.
Yes, good afternoon. Why should I have any confidence in the Miami-Dade commissioners after their miserable, miserable record for the last 30 years on public transportation? I think it's a disgrace.
Fundamental question, Commissioner.
Well, you know, when you put for the last 30 years, when you put an additional about 1.9 million extra people on our everyday roads, and you can try and build yourself out of something with transportation, that's been one area that I believe government at all levels, municipal, county for sure, state definitely, and federal has been remiss. We will never be proactive. We will always be reactive.
What confidence can you give James and others who are skeptical that this time's any different?
Well, you have money committed at all levels, and at least for the next 2 years, I'm going to watchdog it. I have great concern on where my vote is to the integrity of what I'm voting for. So I'm in for another 2 years, and we had a priority. Now we're acting on it. You saw the extension of the bus system down south.
Mm-hmm.
We have the bus lanes east-west, the red zone from the Palmetto to the airport. We're working on the Julia Tuttle on a bus lane. And you have the rail project, at least one stop in Aventura.
Yeah.
For sure. And PTP trolleys.
We have arrived at our destination in our conversation, but I do appreciate your time. It's nice to hear from you again.
Take care. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Thank you very much. That's Miami-Dade County Commissioner Sally Hayman here on the South Florida Roundup. Finally, in the Roundup this week, some voters are casting a ballot for the first time ever. WLRN has been learning about these experiences, sharing those experiences as the voting continues. Laritza Dominguez is a Cuban-American in Miami. She sent us a message in Spanish. Her son, Javier Dominguez, helped out with the English translation.
I've been a U.S. citizen for 22 years. I had never wanted to vote because I don't follow politics, but I was talking to my daughter, and she explained to me the importance of voting this year because our vote could make a difference.
Nuestro voto marcará una diferencia. No estoy de acuerdo con la política de Trump.
I am in disagreement with Trump's politics, and I think my vote could be important in respect to the pandemic. How he failed to listen to the experts, and how that led to us having so much loss of life as we currently have.
De persona que hemos tenido. También no me gusta la manera en que se conduce con la política con los inmigrantes.
I'm not in agreement with the wall he's wanted to build in Mexico, and how he's been in disagreement with young people who have grown up in this country and don't have rights to be able to stay here and exercise their careers.
A poder quedarse aquí y ejercer su carrera. Es importante participar en el voto porque es un derecho.
I think it's important to participate in the vote because it's a right we have as citizens. This is a right that we have here that we would have never had in our country. And I think that we should take advantage of this opportunity that we have.
Que debemos aprovechar esta oportunidad que se nos da.
That's first-time voter Laritza Dominguez speaking in Spanish. Her son Javier Dominguez helped out with the translation. We want to hear from you. Are you voting for the first time this year? What's the race or the issue that has motivated you to cast your ballot, either in person or by mail? You can share your story with us in a text message by texting 786-677-0767. The text line 786-677-0767 to share your voting experience with us. You can find more information about voting and a guide to the November ballot at our website, WLRN.org. Early voting in person underway, vote by mail ballot still being collected. Polls are open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily. Election day, final day of voting, is November 3rd. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The WLRN Director of Radio Programming is Jason Zabka. Director of Radio Operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.